I wonder what this is.
Yeah, what is that?
Unfortunately, I can't tell you.
Bringing to you the best stories from icons in the bourbon industry, it's Bourbon Pursuit. Now here are your hosts, Ryan and Kenny.
Welcome back to another episode of the Bourbon Pursuit podcast. Again here, my name is Kenny, and as always, I'm joined by my partner here, Ryan.
What's up, Kenny? How's it going?
It's going well. You know, we're back down here in downtown again, interviewing our good friends at Angel's Envy. You know, this is the one thing that I really love about coming here is that Angel's Envy is really building something new that they're bringing to downtown, right, with the whole revitalization of what's going on with Whiskey Row. This is just one another of those big name brands that you always see on the shelves that you'll now be able to actually visit when you come here to Louisville.
Yeah, I'm super excited about the whole Whiskey Row experience, just because we live close to downtown, and going to Bardstown and Frankfurt and Versailles, it's fun and all, but there's so much to do downtown, good restaurants, good bars, so I think it'll be great just to be able to come down here, pop into the distillery, hang out, do a tour, bring friends, get a great meal. I'm really excited for it all.
Well, that's great. So let's go ahead and introduce our guest today. So today we have Wes Henderson. Now, Wes is the Chief Innovation Officer, Brand Ambassador. He's got all these different titles here at Angel's Envy. So first, Wes, thank you for being on the show today. We definitely appreciate you taking some time out to talk to us.
Great to be here. Thanks for coming down.
Good. So let's go ahead and kind of talk about maybe your background a little bit. You know, not the stuff we could read on Wikipedia or Google or anything like that, but I guess talk to us about, you know, growing up in a bourbon household, you know, with your father, Lincoln, who was the master distiller here. For in case anybody doesn't know, Lincoln passed away in about 2013, and he was the master distiller here, and you and him helped create the brand. But let's go back a little bit further in time. I guess kind of tell us about, you know, what was it like to either grow up with bourbon and maybe your first sip of it? Do you remember anything like that?
I think the most remarkable thing I remember about growing up around bourbon, well, there are a bunch of things I remember, but that...
It's probably a lot of things we can't remember, too.
Right, yeah. Right. The most remarkable thing when I really think about Dad's lineage in the industry was I really didn't understand, or I'm not going to say appreciate what he did, but, you know, back, you know, 30 years ago, you know, the master, nobody knew who a master distiller was in a company.
Right.
You know, nobody really cared. Nobody knew, nobody cared. I knew my father was obviously extremely smart. I knew he was very creative. I knew he had a brilliant scientific mind. I just never really understood the significance of his place in the history of bourbon until I got much older. Now, I do have memories growing up. I would go to work with my father a lot of Saturdays. He'd go into work Saturdays when I was little. And I would go down to Brown-Forman with my father and the research and development lab. Really, at the time, there wasn't much development going on. It was, or research. It was just the lab, you know.
Where it was, it was Woodford as Woodford, and that's...
Well, even before that, I mean, no, I'm talking, this predates Woodford by a long time. This goes back to the late 1960s and early 1970s when really in the two flagships for Brown-Forman in the United States anyway were Early Times and Old Forester.
Right.
So that was probably your first drink of bourbon was one of those two.
You know, I wish I could really go back and remember when I first enjoyed a bourbon. I mean, certainly I don't want to talk about things that happened before I was 21, but and I would never advocate that. But I do think I'm sure along the way I've tasted sips of things here and there. Mm-hmm. It wasn't until I got to college that I really started, you know, experimenting with different bourbons and whiskeys. And, you know, the crazy thing about it was, you know, I had access to probably some of the best whiskey in the world, and I drank just cheap ass. You know, I think we drank Old Crow when I was in college. That's, you know,
I remember Kentucky Tavern was my
Kentucky
choice.
Tavern was our go-to, right.
And because it was cheap, and you could somewhat drink it without, you know, throwing it right back up. But those were some of the first bourbons or whiskeys that I ever sampled. But you know, I have really good childhood memories of going to work with my father. I like to tell the story that, you know, as we grow up, a lot of people have comfort aromas that they think about, and like be it grandma's apple pie or whatever. And my comfort aroma is when I walk into a distillery, it's the aroma of fermenting mash. I remember that going back to a very young age, even going to Jack Daniel's with my father, or going up to Canada to Canadian Mist, or going to Brown-Forman. So those are the first memories I have of those aromas and fermentation and the distillation process. But You know, I became more aware and more aware as I got older what Dad really did, and as Dad took a more significant place in the industry as, you know, an inaugural member of the Bourbon Hall of Fame, and when he created Woodford, that's when I finally kind of woke up and said, "Wow, you know, look at all these amazing things that, you know, he wasn't just my geeky dad. You know, he was a guy that was an amazing historical character and with a very significant place in the distilling industry."
Well, good. So I guess kind of talk about how that maybe started leading up into Angel's Envy. So I guess give us a little bit of background about what you did in school and how that kind of led you to, at some point, you and your dad kind of merging your minds together and saying, "We got this idea. Let's run with it."
You know, my first jobs were in radio. I started working at, I was a disc jockey at 15 here in Louisville, and worked at several radio stations, several major radio stations here in town. And I was always more intrigued, I think, by the entertainment business and marketing business. And
it's the bright lights and flashing colors.
Yeah,
and
something like
that. Stuff that's in your face versus, yeah.
That's what they say. It's not always like that. But,
yeah, I don't see a whole lot of DJs driving Porsches around town.
No, so. Well, you don't unless you're like one of these, those EDM guys.
Yeah.
And I just found out like last week that a guy I used to DJ with is an EDM DJ that gets paid like, you know, $500,000, you know, to do a show.
It's amazing, especially when you see these Vegas shows out there and you're like, yeah, I mean, they're everywhere and they're getting paid so much money for pool parties and all that stuff.
But it's crazy. But but I'm glad that, you know, and that's a younger person's game, I think. As I got older, certainly, and as I had a family, I gravitated more towards business endeavors and business marketing and sales and marketing and everything like that. I spent a brief time at Brown-Forman, left Brown-Forman. I wasn't a big fan of the Fortune 500 company, you know, that existence.
What were you doing at Brown?
I worked in corporate services, so it really wasn't. It was an interesting job, you know. I did the corporate banking. I did. It was really almost a glorified gopher more than anything. Mm-hmm. But I tell you what, working in that position in corporate services, I worked with, you know, I'd spend time in the mailroom, or I'd spend time with the CEO of the company. I mean, I probably learned more working in that lowly position about the distilling industry than anywhere else, you know, because you saw everything and you were like deep in the belly of the beast. So
right.
You got to see.
You get to go across the horizontal of the right.
And
business.
It, because you were so insignificant really in the pecking order, you know, you were just like a fly on the wall anyway, you know, the people pretended like you weren't there. So because of that, you got to learn a lot of stuff. So I left Brown-Forman and got into several entrepreneurial ventures, which I've built over the years and had a lot of fun doing that. And that really kind of served as a foundation for the experience that I took towards Angel's Envy. And as Dad was getting nearing retirement from Brown-Forman, that's when we really started thinking about doing a project together. I have six children, and I've always, you know, thought about leaving.
It's a lot of college money right there.
Trust me. It's... My 11-year-old asked me a couple of weeks ago. He said, "Dad, if you didn't have all of us, would you be rich?" And I'm like, "Yeah, like hell yeah."
I got this boat named 8 hours of sleep back here. Right?
Poor kid, he'll be stuck in therapy now for a long time after I told him that. But as Dad was nearing retirement, we wanted to do a project together, and we felt like that this might be a great way to do it. And frankly, I don't think Dad really had no idea where this thing was going to go. I really believe that he just said, "Yeah, I'll do it," just because that's what you do when you're a dad and your son asks you to come and do something, not knowing where we would be now. And Dad got to see the company rise very rapidly. You know, he passed away in 2013, towards the end of 2013. So the brand was already making significant progress at that time. And a lot of people say it's one of the fastest. It's a phenomenon that even industry veterans say they've never seen before. And that's because of the rapid growth. That's because of the pedigree of the brand. That's because of the handcrafted nature and the innovation that we bring to the table.
I would also think it might even extend to your location as well, right? I mean, there's a lot of small batch micro distilleries that are kind of doing the same exact thing. But you know, when you think of you hear things like Utah and Texas and Colorado, a lot of the times it doesn't scream Kentucky bourbon to you.
Well, I mean, it doesn't scream bourbon, you know. I mean, and I know most of the in all the states you mentioned, I know the craft guys and all those places. I mean, certainly Kentucky has a lot to do with it. I think timing has as much or more to do with it than anything. Mm-hmm. There's a perfect time for everything to happen, and all these things have come together. But I also think we've really done it better than anybody else. I really believe that. You know, we've got a ton of experience behind us, and we've got wonderful marketing. We've got wonderful wonderful packaging. That's important.
I agree.
You know, and what's inside those bottles is something that is very special. And when you put all those things together, you know, I tell people when you're building something that's very successful, you know, if you, let's say that there's five elements you need to be extremely successful, you know, you can have three elements, maybe four, and have something that works and works well. But very rarely do all of those elements come together. You know, you get those all five and then you hit one out of the ballpark. Mm-hmm. And that's really kind of what's happened with us at the beginning. Now, you know, look, we still got a long way to go. We can still screw something up. But as of right now, we've been very blessed in how things have happened.
Now, when you all first started this company, were you going towards, like, originally, were you thinking port finishes or different finishes? Was that an original thought, or did that just kind of come about?
It I'm not going to say it was a thought right out of the box, but it came pretty quickly. You know, what did come out right away was, I told Dad, look, if we're going to do this, I want to do something that's different, number one. Number two, let's take a look at some of these things you might have experimented with at Brown-Forman that never saw the light of day for one reason or another. You know, and there's a lot of reasons why that stuff never saw the light of day. I think, number one, I think Brown-Forman is a very conservative company, which is great. Great if you're a shareholder. It's not so great if you're
looking, can't take risk.
Right. It's not so much fun if you're looking for innovation. You know, once again, phenomenal company. And it might not have been the right time. You know, we talked about timing just a second ago. You know, there's some products that Dad worked on at Brown-Forman that I think now, if they would have come out today, probably would have been successful, that weren't successful, you know, 30 years ago, almost 40 years ago. So I wanted to take a look at some of the stuff that Dad had really maybe been intrigued with that just never took off for one reason or another. And barrel finishes were something that he always enjoyed playing around with. And I think a lot of it has to do with, you know, there's a lot of variables that go into it that you really don't know how it's all going to shake out. You know, you start out finishing something and, you know, you're sampling kind of as you go along the way, you know, be it 2 months, 4 months, 6 months, a year, 2 years or whatever. But really, before it's all over with, you don't know whether you're going to have a winner or not. So you've got to be in tune enough to what potentially can work and adjust as many variables as you can to make sure you get the best outcome. But it's a tricky game. So barrel finishes are something that we zoned in on rather quickly that we wanted to take a look at doing. And import, you know, there are several different, you can finish bourbon in any type of barrel if you want to, but some of the fortified wines were ones that seemed to have a little more interest because of the taste profile. So, so port was one that we really felt like would be a good way to start. And there are other barrel finishes that we have in development now. And as we get the new distillery open, there's other things, other mash bills, other things that we'll be playing with. I'm very intrigued with historic recipes, with looking back at older production methods and historic recipes that go back pre-prohibition. And we're going to be looking at a lot of that stuff as well, I think.
So is there anything that you tried that failed?
No.
No? Well, I guess, you know, one shot and you're done is one way to go, right? So yeah,
no, I mean, I think the rye took a little bit of our rye whiskey, which is finished in Caribbean rum casks. I'm not saying there's not things that there wasn't anything that we didn't like. It was just a matter of fine tuning, a little more fine tuning than we did with the bourbon. But the sweet spot for the length of period finishing in the barrel, the particular rum that we're going to use to finish the rum barrels, you know, mm-hmm. I sampled.
There's so many of them.
Yeah, I sampled 150 different rums before I found the one that I really wanted, the Plantation XO 20th anniversary rum. And that's a phenomenal rum. So there was a lot more there, a lot more variables in play there, I think, than there were in finishing our bourbon.
Well, you got to take chance, and failing forward is what I call it. When I screw up and things, not screw up, but you take risk and it might not work out perfectly, but you learn and you can perfect it as you go.
Definitely. I mean, there's stuff sitting in barrels now that could be destined to fail. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, there's experiments and other things in development that, and I think fail, I hate that word, but I think there are things that may not turn out the way we anticipated that they might turn out. So, you know, I'm sure there's failure sitting over there somewhere, you know, and we'll figure it out at some point in time. And it's how you look, you know, this is juggling for me. It's not, you know, it's not one ball you're tossing up in the air, you know, constantly over and over again. You've got six or seven in the air. and you know, you're always moving them and always always putting on a show, and then deciding which one of those balls you're going to take out and make it your next release or whatever you're going to do, and the other ones you're still juggling.
Yep. So I guess talk to us about the name. Like, how did you guys think of the name, and it just wasn't becoming Henderson's Family Bourbon?
Yeah, that's a really good story. We kind of have to throw conventional wisdom out the door, which is what we did. We did it with the package design. We did it with the name. We did it with just the overall philosophy. And you know, and when I first started thinking about packaging and names, just like you said, you know, I think not just with our bourbon, but all bourbons, they should be named, you know, Old Colonel something, or you know Henderson's Reserve, or you know, and it's got to be in a square, manly, you know, super manly bottle. It's got to be, you know, all these things that bourbon really used to be,
right?
And those things are changing, so we really had to throw that out the window. So really, the name Angel's Envy came about. We started kicking around the concept of the Angel's Share, which, you know, most people in Kentucky know what that is.
But go ahead and explain to the listeners, yeah, what they don't know what an Angel's Share is.
An Angel's Share is, you know, you put bourbon in a barrel in a hot warehouse in Kentucky, and you're going to lose, you know, anywhere from 3 to 5%, sometimes more, per year in evaporation. So we say that what evaporates out of those barrels and goes into the air, we're sharing with the angels. And so that's where the phrase Angel's Share comes from. So the story behind Angel's Envy is the angels get their share, what they don't get, they're envious of. And that's just how it kind of played out. And then when we started talking about angels and Angel's Share, we thought, of course, anytime you've got angels, you've got wings. And the shape of the bottle started to take that shape as well, you know, because we have wings on the back of the bottle. And it really went from there. The bottle is, as I'm sure most of your listeners have seen, it's almost becoming an iconic bottle. It stands out above a lot of others. It's a heavy perfume grade glass. Mm-hmm. The artwork is phenomenal on it. It's very high quality. It's very heavy. And
it's easily discernible in a lineup when you look at the shelves of all the bourbons. It stands taller than the rest. It's also very wide bodied. So yeah, I mean, it's definitely something that I think you guys did a fantastic job in thinking of the marketing behind it.
I agree. I think we really hit the mark, and it was not. It took a lot of a leap of faith to really go there. You know, we first started designing this package about 5 years ago. This was still at the very cusp of the what I call the craft distilling movement. So everything else out on the market now is still very traditional. Now you're seeing stuff a lot more non-traditional, and I think we can maybe broke the mold there. But it was really a big leap of faith to, you know, when you're so used to these very common packages and common names, to go with something that was very different. And I can't take credit for all that. My team was phenomenal, and it took some convincing on my part to go off the reservation and do something different. I wasn't sold right away.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think, who am I catering to? But there's such a new drinker out there, right? I mean, women are getting into it. People that have never drank bourbon before are finding new ways to mix it in cocktails. So it's essentially becoming a way to reach a new drinker, and I think marketing can expose that, and it can be able to find that as well.
Absolutely. Much different demographic now than there was even 5 years ago, you know, and people, and that makes it more difficult to a certain extent, you know, when you're choosing marketing plans. You know, it's a lot easier to market to a narrow demographic than it is to a wider demographic. And not only do we have a wider demographic now, it's a wider demographic in a bunch of ways. It's not just an age difference. It's a combination age difference, and it's a sex difference now. More, like you said, more women are drinking bourbon. There's an economic component to it as well, you know, what an income is and how much people will spend. So now you've got age, you've got economics, you've got sex, and a bunch of other things that come into play when you're marketing your product. And it's harder to do that.
So there's also some things that I've recently seen on the shelves, probably in the past year, and we're now starting to see a lot more of these, I guess you could say, private barrels that are coming from companies. So can you talk to us a little bit more about maybe a barrel program that you all have, and what's the process that goes through for that, for anybody that's out there that would like to end up going through a liquor store or whatever routes they have to go through to be able to buy a barrel?
Once again,
whatever it would be.
Sure. We had to be different. We didn't want to come to – we wanted to do something along the lines of a barrel program or a special selection program. We created what we call a special blend program. And this is become an amazing hit around the country, because what we'll do is we'll actually come in and sit down with an account and do a custom taste blend of Angel's Envy. Typical barrel programs now, the way they work is if someone wants to do a barrel, you call the distillery or whoever, whatever brand you want to do it with, and they'll send you, they'll go to the warehouse themselves, they'll pick out maybe 6 to 8 barrel samples and send them to you and say, pick one. With our program, we actually allow the account, and we do it with them, we sit down using lab equipment and graduated cylinders and do different blending ratios till we come up with a taste profile that the consumer really, or that the account really appreciates. And then we barrel it, or we bottle it rather, with their name on the side of the bottle. And it's really been cool. The account takes ownership of that product then. Something they've made. And they really push it. They get a chance to be expressive. Now, we don't allow people to go way off the reservation. You know, you'll see some. If you have a special blend next to a regular blend of Angel's Envy, if you have them next to each other, you can definitely sometimes tell discernible differences between the two.
Yeah, I was in South Carolina in Charleston area, and I went to a liquor store. I said, hey, you got anything cool? And they're like, we got some Angel's Envy, you know, the barrel. And I was like, oh, I got some Angel's Envy. And they're like, no, we picked out our own blend, you know, we took 3 or 4, so I tried it right next to him, and you're right, it was different, and it was cool, and I ended up buying it just because I was like, hey, this is a special bottle, and the profile, I liked the flavor, too.
That's great.
So, I mean, do you really think there's a huge amount, but there are those subtle differences between choosing your own versus going with the regular Angel's Envy blend, then?
Yeah, I think that the differences are more subtle than they are huge. And for someone that's not really, really, really familiar with Angel's Envy on a daily basis, if you drank one of the special blends, some of them you wouldn't know it's a difference. I mean, once again, unless you had them side by side.
Of course.
Yeah.
Okay. So I guess there's another specialing bottling that you do every year that's always very, very highly anticipated, and that's the cask strength release. So I guess kind of talk to us about what goes into that process of, choosing the barrels that go into the blend, the marketing behind the boxes and the design and all that sort of stuff.
Cask is a lot of fun. It's something that we probably should have waited to do, you know, as far as the infancy of the brand. But we were really excited about what happened when we dumped the first barrels of Angel's Envy and tasted the first bottlings at barrel proof. As a matter of fact, I took a picture of the first barrel we dumped, and I took a picture of the distillate because the color just amazed me. And at that very minute, I knew that would be our first special release. It was just a matter of when we were going to do it. So this year's special release, this will be the 2014, will be the third one we've done. The bourbon in this release is about a 4-year-old bourbon with an additional 4, almost 5 years finished in a port cask. So you're talking almost 9 years total in wood. And, you know, we select special barrels for that. The selection criteria is really just based upon what I like and what Kyle likes and what we think is going to, you know, be suitable for the – not every barrel is, you know, fits the profile.
Right. So there's definitely a limited amount of what you can put out for this.
Definitely a limited amount every year. You know, everybody would like us to release more, but one thing I learned from my father is, you know, if it's not ready, we're not doing it. If it's not – up to our standards for a particular release, we're not going to release it. We just won't do it. You know, we won't do as many bottles, or if there's more, we'll do more bottles. You know, it's not set in stone. And it's been received very well. We've heard stories of people following the delivery trucks to the liquor store to pick them up. Kentucky, it sold out in a couple days. You might be able to find a bottle lingering here and there in other places. Paul Picoult named it the #1 spirit in the world last year, which was a phenomenal honor. So we're very lucky to have that, and we're going to continue with that release, you know, probably every year.
Well, that's good awesome. To know. That's good to know. So any plans for the 2015 release of the cask strength? I mean, you got the barrels maybe all chosen already, a different kind of flavor profile, anything that you can't talk about?
No, we haven't gotten that far yet. I wish I could say that we are that far out. But it's time to start looking at some barrels. You know, that you can actually finish bourbon for too long, I think, in certain barrels. And, you know, that's one thing you don't want to do. You don't want to cross over that threshold to where it's, you know, it's too much of the influence of the finishing barrel. I think this year's was really kind of the sweet spot, that 4, maybe almost 5 years finishing in a port cask. To go too much beyond that, I mean, it's not that it's not good. It's just that that port, let's say we're talking about port finish, the port just takes such a dominant control over the bourbon that it's so fruit forward. I mean, like I said, I think it's really good. Mm-hmm. It just it's more like the port characteristics just really scream out at you. So I don't know what the sweet spot is. We'll find it. We'll figure it out. But we'll probably start pulling some samples here over the next, you know, 2 or 3 months, and then maybe start setting some stuff aside.
So I guess one of the things that, you know, we'll kind of talk about your day job a little bit as well, right? So, you know, you have the title of Chief Innovation Officer, and when I think about the Angels Envy brand, it's definitely an innovative brand in the way that you deliver a product that really nobody else in the market's doing, or maybe other people are starting to do it. They're kind of catching up. They kind of see how it's taken off. So I guess kind of talk to us about the innovations that you see. You know, talk about what that really means and how you brainstorm these new products that you might one day come out with.
I think it's an ongoing process. You know, you're always looking at, I'm always looking at new products that are on the market. I'm always tasting new things, not just bourbon, but other spirits. And I look for crossovers that may work, you know, flavor combinations that might work. And how would I achieve those in the bourbon arena? I do a lot of pairings with foods. And, you know, I think it's being very in tune with your palate and very in tune with your palate, very in tune with where the industry's headed, where the consumer wants the industry to go. You know, the consumer ultimately is going to dictate what works and what doesn't work by either buying or not buying the product or keep buying it. You know, I mean, you can get a lot of people to buy something once, but it's going to be something they're going to continue to purchase. So you have to really be aware of what's going on in the marketplace. And I talk to a lot of consumers. I talk to a lot of our fans about what they like and what they might like to see next. So literally every day, there's probably some crazy ass thought that pops into my head that
got to find a whiteboard somewhere.
Well,
write it down.
Unfortunately, the whiteboard's in my head, which isn't the best place in the world because I can't even keep track of my car keys.
With six kids, I could imagine you're going to forget a few things here.
Very cluttered space up there. Yeah,
I forgot. I have one child, and I forgot her birthday already. Sometimes,
there you go.
So it's
interesting, and it's an ongoing thing, and I really love it, and it's a very it's a great opportunity to be creative and continue forging forward. And you know, but I'm very big on, you know, I think it's okay to innovate and it's okay to do things that are new, but you still have to honor the history and preserve the history of bourbon as it is, as it has been historically. And so you have to walk that line there, and I feel responsibility to do that.
So talk a little bit about what's going to be going on here. So anybody that doesn't know, we're actually just a few blocks down from where the distillery is going to be. It's at 500 East Main. Is that where it's going to be?
Somewhere down that
so
way.
I guess kind of talk to us about the new distillery and when you can expect those operations to be up and running. And I guess for anybody that is ready to come down and visit you, when they can do it.
Yeah, the new distillery building is across from Slugger Field, which is the AAA ballpark for the Cincinnati Reds on Main Street. And it's a city block. It stretches from Main to Market Street, historic property that we're redeveloping, repurposing for the distillery. We hope to be open first part of the year in 2015. Wait a minute, it's already 2015, 2016. So maybe
you guys are behind schedule again.
It'd be nice to have it open the end of 2015, but you know, who knows? But first part of 2016 will be great. Full production distillery. We'll be, as of right now, we're the only full production distiller that'll be right downtown on Main Street. Now there are other distilleries that are doing things, other companies that are doing show places, but we'll be the only full production operation on Main Street, so you'll be able to see everything. We expect a couple hundred thousand people a year to come through it.
And your prime location, right there off the interstate.
Can't beat it.
Good sight line from the interstate.
Yeah, we got really lucky there, but it was a property that nobody wanted. It sat vacant for years, and as the city grew in that direction, it just nobody scooped it up. We managed to kind of have a little bit of vision there and see where it would fit into our plan. And we grabbed it when we had the opportunity, and there couldn't be a better place for us as far as visibility goes, but there's not many other places downtown from a logistics standpoint that you could operate a distillery. You know, there's trucks involved, there's, You know, there's coming in and out. There are a lot of things that, that are required to, and you couldn't put that downtown, you know, next to the Yum Center or something like that.
Shipping grains and then moving barrels back out. Absolutely. So, yeah, there's definitely a lot of logistics to figure out with that.
Not many places you can do that. So we're about as close into the city that you could get and still be able to do that type of operation.
Yeah, I think it's really special and unique when you talk about being able to do that too, because you know, the Bourbon Trail, it's been good. It's been going on for a really long time. But to do the Bourbon Trail, I mean, it's like 200 miles plus, right? It's, and you can't do it in a day. But you come to downtown of Whiskey Row, you'll be able to see you guys as well as a few more down here, all within, what, 3-4 city blocks, right? So it makes it for a very attractive tourist destination for especially those people that don't want to be sitting in a bus all day or crammed in a car, spending an hour here and an hour there, and then having to drive all the way back to Louisville.
Makes a lot of sense, and that's one of the reasons we decided to do it. We looked at some other properties. We looked at the old Taylor property, you know, out in Woodford County, and we considered things like that. And really, when we brought it back around, it came full circle that Louisville would be the best place to do it. And Louisville has such a historical significance in the distilling industry that's not really spoken about very often. It's kind of the history was, in our sense, kind of robbed from downtown Louisville and taken out to the rural counties in Kentucky. So bringing bourbon back in an urban setting is full circle, you know, really in a lot of ways. So
it's very unique and awesome at the same time.
Right.
Well, good deal. So we're running up on the top of our time right here. But Wes, I wanted to thank you again for your time today. It was a pleasure talking to you about your history, getting some insights with you and your father that started this flagship brand that we all recognize on the shelf. So again, thank you very much for being on the show.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
So if you like what you hear, make sure you subscribe to us on iTunes, tell a friend, follow us on Twitter and on Instagram as well at Bourbon Pursuit.
Yeah, I just want to thank Wes again. Had a great time. If you have any suggestions for interviews, any show ideas, comments, feedback, we'd love to hear it. So hope you guys enjoy, and we'll see you next time.
There we go. Easy enough.